Aussies only. Thanks to GLG Green Life Group, leaders in property services and open space management at glgcorp.com.
Hello and welcome to Aussies Only. It's your host, Jed Zetzer, and today I'm joined by award-winning journalist Courtney Walsh. Courtney talks about his life and journey in tennis, from playing to coaching to entering the world of journalism. I hope you all enjoy the show. Here's Courtney. Courtney, thank you so much for joining me on Aussies Only. Really appreciate you taking the time out of what is a crazy 24 hours for you getting over to the All England Club. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, absolute pleasure, Jed. Speaking to you from the airport in Delhi en route, the freelancer's lot. I'm taking the cheaper option this time, but I will recommend the terminal here. It's not too bad. And if anyone wants a cheaper flight to Europe, I'd say this is not a bad option at this stage. We'll see how the second leg goes, though.
Courtney, tell us a little bit about your childhood and where you grew up. There's so much to talk about your tennis journey with your journalism journey, but tell us a little bit about your childhood and where you grew up.
So, look, I grew up in Ballarat, about an hour and a half, I suppose, from Melbourne, or Gold Rush Town. Eureka Stockade is what it's famous for. Plenty of good footballers, Tony Lockett, for example, the great marathoner, Steve Monteghetti. But I suppose, look, I was introduced to tennis by my dad. He played at the Ballarat Lawn Tennis Club. He grew up in the country, and so I was on the courts with him from a young age. I was having my first lessons in tennis at the Ballarat Indoor Tennis Centre, which no longer exists, sadly, but Rob Benoit, who's still coaching in Ballarat and a ripping fella, he was my childhood coach. I sort of spent, came through, I think I played my first tournament at six and embarrassed myself. I was told to move my feet when returning, and would dance to one side of the court and back to the other. And fair to say, the local number one was able to handle me pretty easily at that age. But I guess from there, look, I absolutely fell in love with tennis. I played a bit of footy as well, but played a lot of tennis all the way through. So I suppose from, 10 or so, I was coming to Melbourne to play sort of tournaments on a pretty regular basis. Started playing Melbourne pennant. We were coming from Ballarat sort of at the age of 13 for Liston, which was a club out in Williamstown, and had Mark Philippoussis sort of lived around the corner, and Joan Kerner, with the former Victorian Premier, was a member there. About 17 or so, I moved to MCC and sort of started playing pennant with MCC. There was a good Ballarat connection there with Peter Keller, who was a top line sort of player all the way through, still an outstanding senior in his sort of late 60s. And then sort of played some pennant with West Melton, Bacchus Marsh, and blokes that I'd grown up playing against, the Kelly Gang. And so we sort of, we played a lot of, I suppose we played a lot of grade one. Like I sort of played a little bit of state grade with MCC games here and there, and then moved to Perth and played state grade over there. And I suppose came back and I'm still playing, still go away and play country every year with some of the guys that I grew up playing against, which is just one of the great events in the calendar. I suppose in my age group, when I was growing up, we had an outstanding crop. So Mark Philippoussis was, clearly outstanding. I didn't play Mark. I got to the semi-finals of the Vic Schoolboys twice, and the guy that crunched me was then crunched by Philippoussis. I remember Andrew Illy played him in a doubles, I think in a national points final in the 18s. Somewhere, and I was wearing glasses at that stage, and he clubbed a forehand so hard straight at me, knocked the glasses off my head. Those two were getting beaten by a guy for a little while called Jung Ming Lee, who was from Korea and based out of Geelong, and he was outstanding. I think he went back to national service and ended up at UCLA later on, but Jung handled me my first ever double bagel, which I think in a final of the Geelong national points, and be fair to say, I haven't forgotten being beaten love and love by someone, but he was so good. But look, I loved it. It was a really good sort of sport to pursue as a kid. It fostered a love for me. I spent some time coaching while I was at university. I was at university in Melbourne, but sort of was still coaching in Ballarat, and spent a couple of years coaching full-time after that before moving into journalism. And look, the beauty of it is I'm still meeting friends around the world who I've played against. You make lifelong connections, and I think that's a great thing about tennis.
Do you think the fact that you were playing at such a high level, because grade one pennant especially is a really high level of tennis just in Melbourne, but I mean, do you find the fact that you played at such a high level and made these connections, has that made your job in journalism a little bit easier, the fact that you've got connections, you know some of the people that you're working with. Has that helped you at all?
Look, I think it has. And look, obviously, I suppose grade one is a really good level. It's obviously, a bit higher and did play quite a lot of money tournaments, et cetera, but didn't have enough talent to push any further than that. But what you did do is play against people or grew up with people who were similarly invested. And so, just even in Paris a couple of weeks ago at Roland Garros during the French Open, those connections were my best mate, who's now coaching for Tennis Scotland, but he was helping out a kid from Australia who was trying to play qualies, just beaten in a super tiebreaker, Edward Winter from Adelaide, another really, really close mate, a guy who I suppose spoke at my 21st. Rowan Fisher is still at Tennis Australia, and he, I didn't actually catch him because he was so busy, but he's done such great things in tennis as well. And, he was heading off to Netherlands with Taylor Preston and done some really good things. So, knowing those people has helped. You've had, I suppose, access to people you've played against, like, another great mate, Brady Hunter, was sort of coaching a lot of the young women. You meet people in bars here and there that you've had connections with. It really does help you, I think, have an understanding or a better understanding of what goes on in the game. I'm certainly not going to profess to know, even a quarter of what goes on everywhere, but you have an idea of what goes on, and it helps you to sort of, I think, generate further interest and love for the sport yourself. And I think at least being able to understand, not, as I said, never played professionally, but certainly played a few, I suppose, attempted to play satellites and that, and played against guys who played, a lot of them are playing against a lot of guys who played college, etc. So you have an understanding of that level of tennis and what it gets to, and I think that can only help.
The connections you make are invaluable. Courtney, when did you fall in love with the sport? Because you mentioned that you've been playing from a young age, that your father introduced you to the sport, but when do you feel like you actually fell in love with it and you thought, yeah, this is awesome?
No, look, I do think pretty much from the first time I was having a coaching lesson, and I remember there was a photo that was taken, which we've still got it, and I had a hell of a lot of hair, like a long blonde, basically mullet, not quite mullet, but more a bowl when I was about four, and I eyes almost shut, poking my tongue out as I hit a forehand. But I just remember loving that environment at the Ballarat Indoor Tennis, and every moment that I had spare, I'd be up there, sort of, we'd play Tuesday night A grade men's from sort of 9 or 10, or maybe 10 or 11. No, probably 10 at 10 years old. You play Wednesday night the A grade mixed doubles. We'd have Macca's squad coaching on the Thursday night. Friday night, I'd have some mates playing in the B men's, and I was up there every night. Probably play footy on the Saturday. You'd play Melbourne Pennant on the Sunday. So I just spent so much of my life sort of around that environment up there. And it was, and that, I think, really did generate a whole community of people who I love and enjoy and still catch up with. And they're people who, in London over the next couple of weeks, I'll be staying with a mate for a few days who, from Bacchus Marsh, I'm going to go to the US Open later in the year and stay with my childhood doubles partner, who we won an Essendon doubles title at sort of 16s or 18s, and one of my other best mates who played a lot of Melbourne Pennant with me. And yeah, he was sort of very, very good junior, a few years younger than me. They're both in New York, go to the British Open after Wimbledon, and same with, as I said, my mate from Tennis Scotland, who we played so much tennis together. I remember when he was really trying to make it, and I was basically the hitting partner with him. And so you had to fall in love because you were doing it every day, basically, or five times a week. And so from a very young age all the way through, I think that love's been pretty strong.
Sean, it's amazing the connections that you make, really invaluable. So, Courtney, when did you decide that you wanted to become a journalist? Because I guess a lot of aspiring tennis players go down the coaching route, or some decide, that they completely want to sort of detach themselves from tennis. When did you decide that journalism was for you?
I guess it was, I always had an interest in reading the paper. So my dad would bring home the Herald in the afternoon, and I'd go through the sport results. And I'd read probably both ends of the paper. I stuffed up an honours year at Melbourne Uni, so I was doing a study into the economic rationalisation of country racing tracks in Victoria and the impact that had on towns. Missed a deadline, which you should never do as a journalist, clearly, but I just got a date wrong, and that stuffed up the whole year. So as a result, I actually tennis coached full-time for 2 years back in Ballarat. and really enjoyed it. We had it, as I said, the crew of coaches. Well, you know, one's gone to just about the top at Tennis Australia in terms of his involvement. The other one works for Tennis Australia now, is at Tennis Scotland. Another one ended up as, you know, chief executive of Tennis Queensland for some time, and a couple of just outstanding coaches, you know, in locally who did great things. So we had a great group of coaches, but it wasn't for me. Like I enjoyed it, but I think I wanted to write. And so I basically decided to do journalism and did a postgrad in journalism sort of in my second year while still coaching, and was able, lucky enough to get into the Herald Sun. I got a cadetship there, worked as a news journalist for 4 years, but always clearly had an interest in sport. And when a job popped up in WA with the Australian newspaper, I was able to get across there. And I'd worked a little bit for a community newspaper called MX Writing Sport. And basically from there, I was able to sort of move into sport journalism, and clearly given my sort of passion for tennis and for footy, but for tennis, it was not a bad fit for me. And it sort of enabled me to start writing at length about tennis.
Fast forward a couple of years, 2019, your incredible work was recognised when you were awarded the Ron Bookman Award, which is the ATP's recognition for the best tennis journalist in the world for that given year. Can you just tell us about that experience? Because what an incredible, incredible award to receive. How proud were you of yourself in that moment in time?
Look, I was really, I've got to say, I was surprised. I wasn't necessarily expecting it. And it was a real honour when I sort of was alerted. You know, I guess you wake up overnight from the news from Europe, and I'd received an email from Nicola Rosani, the ATP sort of head of comms, who's a very decent man and very helpful. You look through the honour list and you see, just from the Australian sort of perspective, you see, you know, Alan Atwood, I think, is on there, and Linda Pierce, who was a top-line journalist, still a top-line journalist for Code of Sports, but for The Age. And then you look at some of the other writers who have won it, Christopher Clary, who is a, you know, a wonderful writer for the New York Times, and I think he's won it a couple of times. Bud Collins, who's sort of iconic in tennis journalism. And you know, Kevin Mitchell, for example, I think won the year after me. Praj from India won this year. It really does have an accomplished list of journalists. So to think that I would even be considered in that was incredible. And I'm still not certain I deserve to be there, but it was a good year in terms of just from a, you know, I wrote a really sort of decent detailed feature on Alex Diminor, for example, which ran as a cover story for the Weekend Australia magazine. And to get a Weekend Australia magazine sort of cover as a journalist was a big thrill. I've sort of had a couple with Ash Barty, but Diminor was Enter the Demon and sort of wondering where he would get to, and, you know, had photos sort of teed up in Portugal where he was playing and talking to his mum in Spain, and Alex sort of around the world at different stages was a thrill. But also it was a lot about the ATP Cup and where we were going, what was happening with Tennis Australia at the time, where the ATP were going. I was able to get a lead on a couple of those things. So that helped me. But it was a real thrill, and it's something that I'll really treasure. And, you know, I think I was presented the award on court by at Pat Rafter Arena during the ATP Cup by Jerry Armstrong, the umpire who was famously involved in a McEnroe stash many years earlier, but has done great things with the ATP since. And a good friend of mine, Neroli Meadows, who, you know, she's a star in sort of sports broadcasting. She was the on-court announcer. So it was really a really nice moment. And to be presented on Pat Rafter Arena. Well, Pat was such an icon when you're growing up, and I've always found him so brilliant to deal with, you know, in the years in my time in journalism. So I really liked that. It was a real thrill.
I guess just recognition that you deserve firstly, but also just a whirlwind moment would have been incredible.
I wasn't booed, so that was a good thing.
Courtney, you mentioned obviously working with Alex Diminor for that piece. Can you tell us about some of the athletes and also just some of the people in general that you've, I guess, written about, and some of the maybe crazy experiences that you may have had over your time?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I guess in journalism, in tennis journalism, the 15 years or so I've been, or 16 years I've been properly involved has been, you've seen the legends. So that's been a wonderful thing in itself, from Federer and Nadal and Djokovic and Serena Williams through to, I've got to say, you know, Ash Barty has been outstanding to cover for quite a few years, and Sam Stosur as well has always been wonderful to cover. So, you know, I've been very lucky in that perspective. Look, even before, probably the one story I loved the most actually happened while I was still a news journalist, and we didn't write about it, but it was an amazing experience. I was Davis Cup semi-final, Australia versus Switzerland at Melbourne Park. Just went with a couple of friends. I was, as I said, a news journo. Went with a then girlfriend and another really close mate. And see Hewitt get over the line against Federer was incredible, from two sets and 5-3 down, and to clinch that tie. He clearly had a few beers and must have had quite a lot, because we ended up at a casino nightclub, which is not something I would ever normally do. And we walked in, and the first thing we saw was Marc Rosset, the Swiss player, you know, walking around with a couple of darts in his hand. And we've gone, wow, that's incredible on a Sunday night late in September. And then we walk in, and it was not that busy. And we see the Swiss guys, Federer, George Bastel, Rosset, et cetera, in this nightclub. No one really recognised them. And if you think about the timing, it was 2003. So before Facebook, before Twitter, et cetera, Federer had won Wimbledon a couple of months earlier. But realistically, in Melbourne on a Sunday night, not many people at a nightclub are going to necessarily recognise him at that stage, because he hadn't, you know, tennis players knew who he was. And so we looked at them, and my mate was wearing a Wimbledon T-shirt from that year underneath his shirt. Another friend had sent it across. So, and I don't hate hassling athletes, but, you know, clearly they'd had enough and went over and said, Roger, you won this. You know, do you mind signing? He said, no. He said, oh, yeah, okay. So I raced downstairs, was able to grab a pen, ran back upstairs, and Roger signed my mate's shirt, sort of, you know, Roger Federer 2003. And we steered clear from them. George Bastel did try and hit on my girlfriend while we were standing there. So I thought that wasn't tremendous, but nonetheless, he's still doing well. He played a mate of mine a few weeks ago in Switzerland and knocked him off 2-2. And Federer was dancing up and down against the wall, having a great time. So you sort of saw Federer in a different light to what, you know, I guess you would normally see. It was an amazing experience. So that was sort of, that wasn't quite in the journalism side. I guess from writing about them, Nadal once in Shanghai a few years ago, to see the way he handled the adulation was unbelievable. Myself and another journalist just got back from the site. We were staying in the same hotel. The foyer was crammed with people. Nadal arrives. We got off the shuttle. Nadal arrived in his car, and he was mobbed. We're talking, there had to have been at least 200 people in the foyer as he's making his way through. So we got through, and we just sort of thought, see how this goes. And he signed everything. He posed for photos. He did, you know, as much as you could possibly imagine from a guy who'd finished late at night. So generous. And then he gets to the lift well, and they hold the lift, and he gets in, and then we hear him say, hey, those guys, pointing to me and my colleague, they were here first, let them in. So he stops the lift, you get in and say, hey, how you going, guys? And we share the lift up with him. To watch the way he handled everything, he was with Mark Lopez and a couple of others. It was astonishing to see just his general demeanour, given, as I said, he was properly mobbed by people, but he signed and did everything. Ash has been wonderful to cover, you know, sort of through her career. I remember when she walked away from the sport, I sort of spoke to her in a tiny little hotel room in New York about 3 weeks earlier with another Aussie journo. And, you know, she was clearly really struggling at that time. And, yeah, you sort of hoped the sport hadn't lost her. And to see her come back and do what she's done has been immense. I've had the good fortune of sort of traveling with her to a couple of different experiences, which have been mind-blowing. Up to Cairns about 2 or 3 years ago with her and Yvonne, sort of spent the day covering, as she did a clinic, you know, jumped, she gave me a ride back into town, sort of, you know, talking about golf, this and that. She was fantastic. Went to Uluru with her in February, and to see her sort of coaching kids on the red dust in the shadows of Uluru was awesome. And, you know, her dad's a wonderful guy. In fact, I'm sure the whole family, I haven't had much to do with her mum, but the whole family, but her dad's a ripper, and she's just someone who's very, I think, so good for the game. So that's been great. Look, Nick, I found him hot and cold, but I appreciate his talent, and at different times he's been absolutely fantastic to me. I do find with Nick, you ask him a question that he can respond in terms of talking about other players or other, you know, certain topics, and he will give really insightful answers. The ATP, at the time we were really struggling, I was flown over to Tokyo a couple of times to cover the Japan Open, and with the basis around sitting down with Nick for a proper detailed interview. He won the Japan Open in Tenerife and said, nah, sorry, mate, I can't be stuffed 1 year. And then the next year he went to China afterwards and, you know, had a meltdown on court against Steve Johnson. I reported it, and, you know, that, which you have to do. And another occasion where he's walked up middle of the night, about 2 o'clock in New York, he's just had a good win. It's been a long day for everyone, because you're out in New York at about 11 a.m. and he's still sitting there about 2 a.m. filing. And it was a couple of Dorothy Dixer questions, you know, straightforward questions. Hey, how you going? Well done. And he dropped the ATP's corrupt line. It's like, oh, no one wanted it. His agent's going, oh God, pull him away. So, but I look, you know, for, look, I can't call, I suppose, some of the antics towards the umpires, but everything else I don't mind as much. I think, as I said, I got two trips to Japan for no interviews, which wasn't ideal, but I had a great time. So I've always found him sort of very interesting to cover. Bernie, I've never found to be, I mean, for all, you know, the stuff that he's done wrong, I know he's polarizing figure, he at least will always ask when you walk into a press conference, how are you going? Or, you know, I find him actually okay in those sort of situations. I remember once going down to cover him when he was 14, he just had another really good junior result. In Sale, he played Nick Lindahl in the first round of the Challenger tournament. Nick's, you know, subsequently done for match fixing, but Nick was, you know, really talented player. Beat him in three sets and sat down and Bernie and had a chat. And he was fine, and then his old man basically shouldered me as I was walking through the door, which was an interesting experience. So, you know, John, a couple of different stages, you could see there was some volatility there. So I suppose it's been interesting to cover different individuals, and yeah, it's been some sort of really good insights, but also some pretty weird and wild moments.
Incredible. I still can't get over seeing Roger Federer in the casino nightclub on a Sunday night. That is just unbelievable. One of the great stories that I've heard.
Like, I don't think anyone else would have recognised him. Aside from grabbing, you know, saying, did mine sign on my mate's shirt, we didn't hassle them at all. But it was just, you know, fascinating to sort of dance near them and see how they were going about it. And no one really recognised them. And they were just having a great time among themselves. And, you know, clearly it was a really difficult defeat for them because they wanted to win a Davis Cup so much. And, you know, they managed to do that many years later with Wawrinka. Oh, the other one was Wawrinka. I still can't believe this happened. The day, you know, he wins the Australian Open final 2014, I think it was, just thinking back, 2014, 2015, 2014, I think it was. Yeah. End of a long fortnight. We head up into town afterwards, as with every Australian Open, you don't get out of there till well after midnight, 1 o'clock. Went to the supper club, which we knew would be open for a late night drink. And I was with a couple of colleagues, Courtney Newen from the WTA. And Nerilli, I think, was there as well. She was at a different part. And I was with Alex Willis or Lee Walsh or someone like that. And we're sitting and having a quiet drink when from Siglo upstairs, Stan Wawrinka and the whole party walk downstairs. And the Siglo's closed upstairs. They've walked downstairs. They come into the supper club. And because they had about 8 people or 10 people in the group, they wouldn't let them in. There was plenty of space, but they were saying we're only sitting groups of 6. Stan had a glass of champagne. He's dropped it on the couch. Couldn't believe it. I think Nerilli's rushed over and said, what are you doing? This guy's just won $2.5 million in the Australian Open. And they said, no, we don't care. We turn back rock stars here. So Stan and his crew headed off, couldn't get into the supper club. He couldn't believe it. And this is his parents. Like, it was barely a rowdy lot. It was, I reckon he would have bought the most expensive bottle of wine on the list that night. So I think they headed off to Commercial Road and had a, I think they turned up at the Tennis Australia party and he was putting away beers and shots at the bar at 6 a.m. is my understanding. So always a good, apparently he's got some going in Stan.
I mean, that's just literally time and place, just being in the right place at the right time, be able to witness those types of things.
Pure fluke in a regard, or you know, clearly pure desperation for a beer to end the fortnight, but clearly had the same idea.
Courtney, I want to speak about a sport which is growing rapidly around the world and has recently hit the shores of Australia, paddle. I've played it 3 times this week. I'm absolutely addicted since you introduced me to it going back a month or two now. I just want to speak about paddle, and you've been to Las Vegas earlier this year. Can you tell us a little bit about that sport, how you got into it, and just for those who might not have ever heard of it, I guess what paddle is?
Yeah, the good people down at One Paddle are looking after you. I'm glad to hear it. It's one of the random things. Look, a couple of years ago, I was lucky enough while covering the AFL to head up to the Gold Coast. I got out of the lockdown and covered the last 2 months of the season up there. You know, I did quarantine, et cetera. And a great mate of mine, Brad Sewell, the former Hawthorn Best and Fairest Premiership player, he grew up not far from Ballarat, and he was a really, really talented tennis player, still loves it. Had the good fortune of Pat Cash has got him onto Wimbledon and onto Roland Garros. He's a Hawthorn man. So Sully hits a really nice ball and we hit whenever we can. Living in Byron Bay at the moment, at the time, he loved paddle and he would go out to the KDB Centre with Ross Taylor, who is an outstanding player in paddle, a really good coach up there. And so he invited me out to play. Another great mate, Brett Hunter, who, you know, Ballarat boy, who you know, outstanding coach as well. So played that day. I was a bit hungover. Not a theme here, but, you know, you journo, sometimes you go out for a beer. And it was just loved it. The reflexes, the back and forward, the touch needed, I suppose the strategy, that it was chess-like. So I found that fascinating. When they opened up in the Docklands, I had a really good mate of mine, Rob Daly, who was a long-time state grade number one and, you know, beat some really, really good players, played sort of through France and Germany. And so we went down and sort of played a little bit. Clearly, the World Senior Championships came up. They must have been desperate for a player because I got the call up to go across and play in the 45s. Gives away my age, but the 45s for Australia in the World Championships, in the World Senior Championships in Las Vegas in March. And it was fantastic. We were beaten largely on the court. It certainly was an introduction for the group of death. Brazil knocked us off early into Argentina, who have been dominant in the sport for forever. They knocked us off very handily, but we improved a lot, and the trajectory improved was great by the end. And the team had a win over Denmark, so we that was good. Australia, I think in the men's, we finished 14th. It's the first ever time Australia's won a match on the world, you know, in the World Championships. So tremendous group of guys and girls. I love the fact that it's men and women, similar to tennis. And it's a sport, I think, which is an equaliser. I mean, look, clearly at the top level, and there were Spaniards just off the professional tour who were unbelievable, and the Argentinians were incredible. So to I suppose to put it in perspective, it's been really big sort of in Spain and sort of through South American countries for a long, long time, but growing at a rapid, rapid rate. You've got, I think, a mate from Head told me that they sold twice as many padels in Spain last year as they did tennis rackets, given Rafael Nadal has been such a dominant player in tennis. And they've got some top liners, Bedosa, for example, and so many good men over the years, Sanchez Vicario. Through Scandinavia, you know, in Sweden, I think there's five times as many padel courts now as what there is tennis courts, which, again, went from a country that had Verlander, Borg, Edberg, you know, some of the greats in terms of men's tennis. When we played in Vegas, there was some old tennis players. So Elke Klister's sister of Kim was playing for Belgium. We played Marcos Daniel, a Brazilian. He got to about 50 in the world. Jens Nipschild, who was a top 100 player from Germany, who played Worcester in a third round. We played against those two guys. Jared Palmer, an Aussie Open doubles winner in 95, a former world number one. He was playing for the States. And there was a couple of others that have been touring tennis players. It's basically, it's a hybrid of tennis and squash, I think. Look, defense is really important. It's a really strategic game. Power is not always your friend. You've played it, Jed, so you'd understand that. Where it goes in Australia, I'll be fascinated. Clearly, there's some good investment sort of in the Gold Coast, now in Melbourne. Perth's got a great sort of setup. I understand Sydney's got a great setup. There was a world champs, Australian sort of trials last weekend there. You know, I received notice this week from the French Tennis Federation accreditation for Roland Garros. There's a tournament the week after Wimbledon, which will be held at Roland Garros. Another notification popped up for a tournament in London the weekend after that. So it's growing. Qatar's throwing a lot of money at it, similar. So there's a bit of a breakaway like golf. So it'd be fascinating to see where it goes. But it's really a great sport. It's a lot of fun, and I'd encourage anyone to have a crack at it.
Just simply having fun out on the court. I also find that it's quite an easy sport to play for those who aren't amazing at sports. So anyone can play it. Anyone can pick up a paddle racket and actually have a good time and be competitive. So Courtney, you've had an incredible career in journalism, and I mean, you've already achieved basically the Hail Mary in tennis, winning the Ron Bookman Award. But do you have any goals for the future that you've really got your heart set on achieving? Like, what's next for you?
That's a really good question. The Holy Grail might have been winning the Slam or something like that. I would have given anything to be good enough to even play a match on the professional tour. I'll take the Bookman Award. Look, it's a good question. I still think your duty is to try and do every story as good as possible. So I know that sounds strange, but I think your next story should always be the one you're trying to focus on and do as well as you can. Recently been ghosting a couple of athletes in terms of footy players and also a tennis player in terms of writing, helping them write their columns or write their books. And I think it'd be interesting. At some stage, I wouldn't mind actually turning my head to trying to do a proper book on the tour. I have a colleague, Will Swanton, who wrote a great book a few years back called The Slams. Had a good fortune of sort of, you know, sitting with Chris Clary for lunch and for dinner on the final day of the last two Slams, sort of in Melbourne and in Paris, and And he has written a tremendous book on Federer, which I highly encourage everyone to sort of go and get. And I've got another really, really good mate, Simon Camp, who's an English journalist who always stays with us in Melbourne. And he and Graf from Switzerland, Simon Graf from Switzerland, I think Simon, are writing Federer as well. So something along those lines would interest me. You know, where that comes or what the topic is, I think it's still to formalise. Like I've got some ideas, but it's a matter of trying to do that. So I think something like that would be good. But look, in the meantime, I just think trying to tell the story as well as possible and try and provide some insight. You know, you're only as good as your last story, and I think it's important to sort of, you know, to remember that you're writing for other people. You're trying to tell the story for other people, and you should try and approach each one as well as possible. So it's probably not a long time. I hope I'm involved for many more years to come. You don't know, like it's an uncertain world, but I do hope I get the chance to keep telling stories for a while to come yet.
Certainly. And just one last one for me, Courtney. You mentioned the story that you wrote and the work that you did with Alex Demonar. If not that, what is the proudest, I guess, story that you've put together? What are you most proud of?
In terms of features, yeah, because there are different elements of stories and different skills that are needed. Look, I really loved a couple of the pieces I've done with Ash, the behind-the-scenes things and the access that you have and the way you can tell them and just seeing how amazing she is when she deals with all manner of people and how generous she is with her time. So I think a couple of the ones on Ash have been absolutely as proud as can be. Look, there's a certain sense when you write difficult stories, you know, some people might think the journalists go out of their way to slam people. I've always tried not to. I think, but when there's a hard story that has to be written, you have to do it. And it still takes a bit of guts to confront someone or to pick up the conversation, pick up the phone and make the difficult call to say, hey, this is what's happening. So you can cop some difficult ones. And, you know, I've written a few through the years, which, you know, have been hard moments. And, you know, you hate them, but there's also a part of you that goes, well, that had to be done. You had to make those calls. And then, you know, just away from tennis, I suppose some of the, you know, there's been some really difficult sort of stories in terms of, you know, tragedies, et cetera, where, you know, I remember being, you know, to give an indication of one, writing a story about Serena Williams winning the 2012 US final, sitting in a diner in New York about 1 o'clock in the morning. Andy Murray, who had the good fortune of ghosting his columns for The Australian for sort of 3 or 4 years, and he was a tremendous fellow, was due to play the final the next day. When word came through that a footballer had fallen off a roof in Las Vegas and was in a bad way. And so it was a tragic story. John McCarthy from Port Adelaide, formerly Collingwood, had fallen off the roof of the Flamingo and died. And look, within a few hours, you're on the plane, sort of through Washington to Vegas, picked up by a photographer. You're at a coroner's office at 9 o'clock talking to the Las Vegas coroner, you know, in a one-on-one. And then I think I slept about maybe 6 hours and about the next 72 hours sort of on the phone back and forth from Australia, chasing different things. It was a really difficult story. It was one that, you know, you had to do. And I guess the work through that period, I think that was an important one. And just to go from the, you know, thinking you're writing about Serena Williams writing the US Open, winning the US Open title in a diner at 1 o'clock in the morning to reporting on a tragedy sort of 10 hours later, it shows how quickly life can turn. And, you know, you need to be able to think on your feet and sort of do things and balance the different demands of the job. So that one was one that will always stick with me.
That would have been an absolute whirlwind of a, not even just a 10 hours, but a 72 hours, as you mentioned. Courtney, I really appreciate you taking the time to join me. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've loved hearing about all these stories. I think that it's been certainly one of the more insightful chats that I've had on this show, from Roger Federer in a nightclub in Melbourne to Stan Wawrinka at the supper club. I've absolutely loved every bit of it, mate. So really appreciate you taking the time to join me, and also appreciate you giving me some guidance at the slams, particularly the Australian Open. There's been some moments where you've helped me with some little things, and I really do appreciate that.
Oh, no, Jed, look, thanks for having me. As I said, I hope I don't sound too much like a, I suppose, what's the word they use? Flog is the one they use, which I hate. But anyway, I'm really, really love your engagement and enthusiasm in tennis. And I think it's the more the better. And I'm glad that you're doing these things. I think it's great to hear from different people in the industry. So thanks for having me on.
Really appreciate it. Thanks, Courtney. And we'll be sure to chat again soon.
Absolutely.
Well, what an incredible journey Courtney has had Thank you so much for tuning into this edition of Aussies Only. Be sure to tune into any previous edition of the show. I've had some incredible chats with some incredible people. Head over to thefirstserve.com.au to tune into any previous edition of the show. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's edition of Aussies Only.
The First Serve is your home of tennis at thefirstserve.com.au. Log on to find out all the details of our live radio show, other podcasts, read weekly features by our team of writers, and follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I'm in it to win it.